The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do? The podcast where I, your host, Deader Dennis Maller, talks to artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And the artist and entertainer on the podcast today is clown, performer, and former marine biologist, Bree Crabtree. She is somebody that I discovered through the internet, through TikTok. She came up in my algorithm. She is a clown performer in the San Francisco Bay Area who does children's shows. Now, Dennis, why are you watching children's show performers? Because I now have to perform for children. That's why. And I need all the skills and techniques and tips that will make me a better performer in my career. She is very talented, very funny, and she's doing a series of videos now where she's not just showing her performances, but she's talking about the methodology behind working with children and performing for children. And I found a lot of that fascinating, and we talk about that on the podcast. And of course, I also wanted to talk to her because I don't have any clowns on the show. No, well, we had Brian Fulton, Dangerous Brian, Brian Dangerously, my old high school friend. He is a clown and a juggler and a performer and was on the podcast. We've had Steve-O from Jackass, who is famously somebody who was a clown and went to clown college just as well as Brian did. In fact, I wanted to bring up the clown college stuff with Bree, but we never got around to it because she has a lot more other fascinating things to talk about. When she started out doing this just as a hobby as a teenager and didn't tell anybody. Like, I cannot imagine not telling everybody about my passions. I don't know what that life is like. I tell everybody about everything. Like, I'm not very private at all. I can't keep secrets very well. But it was a joy to listen to her talk about her journey and her experience being a children's entertainer and growing up in the clowning, entertainment, juggling, and that world, and finding what niche worked best for her and where she is wanting to be at in her career. So please enjoy my conversation with clown and juggler, Bree Crabtree. The amount of times that I, while talking back and forth and like emailing you and, you know, show prepping, looking up, researching you, the amount of times my iPhone has tried to change your name from Bree to Bro is incredibly frustrating for me. And I gotta imagine probably the bane of your life.
I get a lot of texts that start with Bro.
they had good intentions. 20 plus years in the radio industry and the audio industry and live sound. I have this nice professional studio that I made at home. And the thing that fails all the time is the desktop computer. It's always the computer that's the big problem.
I know. I did a lot of Zoom shows and that would take me by surprise too. Just an update. And you're like,
Well, here's the worst part of it. Like, I have this nice professional, same thing would happen during Zoom. I have this nice professional microphone. I got all this good thing. And then like when something's not working, they're like, well, you have all that expensive equipment. Why is it not working? It's like, look, it's the one thing that I didn't spend money, that I couldn't spend enough money on was the computer, okay? Even if you have a nice computer, it's still going to mess up somewhere.
Yeah. I bought a new computer over pandemic so I could do the Zoom shows. Yeah, you're right.
So let's start with that because as many people who listen to the podcast have become very familiar with, I can't stop talking about the pandemic. It's affected our lives in ways so much farther reaching than we truly ever believed it was going to. Like, as a comedian, so many of us was like, oh yeah, we'll probably talk about pandemic stuff in our act for a little while, but we'll probably not continue to keep talking about it. We're 4 years now from the pandemic and it's still affecting our everyday life. So for you as a performer, like for me as a comedian, when the pandemic hit, and also as like a person who's worked in TV and radio his entire life, I was well equipped for the pandemic. All I did, here's the entire thing that I changed about my studio at the time, is I moved the camera from there to here. That's it. Like, all the stuff that's cool against the back wall is what I would look at when I did anything, you know, recording wise in this studio to inspire me. And then I just turned the camera around 180 degrees. It's like, all right, cool. Here's all the cool stuff for everyone to look at while we're on my Zoom things. Was it easy for you, who is somebody, a physical performer, to adapt to the online world of the pandemic performing?
I think my biggest challenge was figuring out a little bit of the tech stuff, like hooking up a nice camera, getting the lights. But I kind of roll with the punches of whatever's happening. So I did pivot to virtual shows, and I probably did over 300. And yeah.
300, though, that's a lot of shows.
Yeah. Yeah. I started a virtual birthday party business.
So doing 300 shows, was there an adaptation to your act that you had to figure out how to do it for people, for the camera?
Yeah. So it did take me a couple of weeks to figure out that unicycling far away is not very engaging, but being up close like this with a puppet, I actually switched to a lot of puppetry. I switched to some close-up magic. I practiced way more magic. And just like really silly props that even something like this sticker here, like I would just interact with it as a character. And I actually learned some new audience engagement techniques. I relied a lot on call and response for I say something and then the kids say it back. Cause you know, that's kind of one of the only interaction things you can do.
Yeah, you can't really ask the kids like, hey, can you get in a car and drive to my house, come in my room, go ahead, it's unlocked, just come right on in, and we're going to do, I need you to hold this or pick this card for me. Yeah, that kind of doesn't work over Zoom.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of the interaction turned to call and response, asking the kids to do things like that. And
were there difficulties getting kids engaged with interacting through the camera? Was there different techniques you had to learn to, like, interacting with people face to face is one skill and one trait, and then having to get them to engage with now realizing that the screen they're looking at is not TV, the screen that they're looking at is not fictitious, it's somebody who's there with them. Was there new ways that you had to learn to get kids to engage and go, hey, I can really see you, little Bobby, and I can really talk to you, and you can talk back to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the techniques is to, call the kids out by their name, which I do in person, too.
That's fascinating to listen to. And reassuring for me, because I one of the reasons that I latched on to some of your TikToks was your work with kids, because I don't work with kids. Well, I do now. I am a tour guide for here in the city of Boston now. And so now I have learn to engage with children, not just like parents bringing their kids on tour. We do whole 80-minute tours for school groups, for everything from elementary school up to high school kids. And
very cool.
That was, as a stand-up comedian, I'm in the world of adults. I've done, all-ages shows. I've done clean comedy. I've interacted with children. It's not my strong suit. My jokes and stories don't work with kids. They're not that I'm that great or cerebral. I'm not built for kids. So I've had to learn how to interact with kids. And one of the things that I've been doing a lot this season is not only looking up our seating charts so I can have people's names, but actively calling people by their names. Well, obviously, when I work with beforehand, what I would ask, which I would ask somebody their name, but I am the worst at remembering kids' names. And it's almost embarrassing to the point how bad I will ask somebody their name and then they'll tell it to me and I'll go back to them again and then completely forget not only what their name was, that I forgot their name in general. So it's reassuring to hear somebody who's like you, who works actively with children, that you also do that same technique of, I'm going to make sure I call people by their name, because a lot of people at work think it's weird that I want to know everyone's name that comes onto my tour bus. And I'm like, no, it's engaging. It's endearing. It makes them feel like they're part of it.
Yeah, there's a couple reasons to do it. Yeah, I think it's worth memorizing people's names. Sometimes I try to memorize all the kids at the birthday party. Like, I can only do up to like maybe 15 names, but I don't know. It makes people feel special when you call them by their name. It gets their attention right away. It's a sign you're listening. And usually you learn the kids' names who are acting out. Those are the names you learn first.
I call them the Kyles. That's the act out kids are the Kyles in my life. Because every kid grew up had a Kyle. And if you don't know who your Kyle was, as I say in my act, you were Kyle.
Yeah.
So speaking, all right, so going back to working with children, why? But I'm going to ask you more of a question than just the why part, actually. What was it, because you started performing at a young age, you know, juggling and learning the unicycle. I've talked to other performers that, like my friend Jack the Whipper, who is a Renaissance Fair whipcracker and also huge online now. Great. I'm happy for all his success. But he started circus performing because his father was a circus performer.
That's right. He's from a family of performers. That's right. Right.
Yeah. And so is that similar to you as well? Did you have an influence from someone in your family life or someone close to you that made you want to, like, did you have an uncle who was at Christmas one time juggling a couple of lemons? And you're like, oh, I want to learn how to juggle that. Where did the desire for juggling
come from? I have no idea. I just woke up one day in my teenage years and I was like, I want to learn how to juggle. It was just kind of a random, I don't know, something in my brain just got switched on. And around that time, like around, you know, 15, 16 years old, it all kind of came together, like being interested in juggling and magic and unicycling and face painting and balloon animals all at once. I don't know. I was just attracted to it for some reason. And my mom found a local clown troupe I could join. So that was my main influence. And the clown troupe would bring in teachers to train us on some of these different skills.
So what area of the country did you grow up in where you were able to find this local clown group?
I grew up in San Bernardino, California.
Okay.
Which has very little, I don't know, artistic culture in a way. I was just watching a TikTok of 10 worst cities to live in. San Bernardino always makes the top 10 of these lists.
Well, I live in Boston now, but I originally am from and grew up in Baltimore. So I can understand with the, hey, yep, there's my city on the list of highest murders in the country again. So I can understand where you look at those lists of your hometown, like, this is not a good list to be on.
Yeah, there's a lot of crime, a lot of drug use. But at that point in time, my mom found this clown troupe run by a Girl Scout troop.
Yeah, and you're about the same age as me. Like, I grew up in the 80s. So even the resource of finding something like that nowadays throughout most of the country is pretty difficult. Like in your local area, yeah, we can find 1,000 magicians and teachers of these things online now. But to find someone person now is difficult
before,
in certain parts of the country. And then back then in the 80s, like, was your mom looking for that and it coincidentally found it? Or she was like, oh, hey, there's a clown thing. Brie likes clowns.
My parents definitely nurtured what I was interested in. So she would take me to, I got to see the Karamazov brothers as a teenager. She took me to see Penn and Teller. They did
a great job. I'm jealous you got to see Penn and Teller because I haven't seen them live yet. I love them.
They did a great job exposing me to these different art forms and encouraging it and fostering it. And they even connected me with a juggling teacher who lived nearby. There happened to be an ex-professional juggler who lived in the town nearby. So I got really lucky and was trained by these people in my teenage years. And I did that, you know, as like a lot of volunteer and service work to put on my high school resume.
Well, you sound like you had very supportive parents, which is not typical for a lot of people in the arts, but it's not rare. So it's nice to hear that you had supportive parents, especially probably when you start becoming more of an adult and you graduate college. You're like, hey, I think I'm going to make clowning a full-time career. Were your parents still being supportive about this?
I never said that out loud. I never told anybody what I was doing. Right. So after college, I did have a lot of part-time jobs trying to use my degree. And my degree is in wildlife biology. And you know, the state of the environment is just a little depressing.
And we're talking about late 90s, early 2000s, and it's still even not getting any less depressing now.
Yeah, so I moved to the Bay Area and I worked for a little bit in the sciences. I worked in the entomology world with insects. And at the end of the day, you're spending the entire day working on somebody else's project, under somebody else's terms. And sometimes I feel very defiant towards authority. And I like to be my own boss.
So you had supportive parents growing up through this. Did you find it difficult to find as a young female in magic and clowning and juggling? Did you find it difficult to find support amongst your peers?
I didn't tell a soul. I hid it all. None of my high school
Really?
friends knew I was doing it because I was
Wow.
terrified of, first of all, I was so shy, debilitatingly shy. I would never, ever put myself in a situation where I was going to have the whole room looking at me.
That's
So,
not uncommon. That's
therefore,
not uncommon in performers. They're shy on the outside, but then when they get on stage, that's when they can release themselves.
So I hid it from most of my friends. I never did it in a talent show. I never shared it with my classmates. And then, you know, eventually when Facebook was invented and some of those people, I started reconnecting with some of those people. They were like, wait, what? You're doing what? Who are you?
Have you performed for any of your former childhood friends' children's yet?
Have for my college friends' kids. So then when I went to college, I did open up more. I had more freedom. And so I do keep in touch with those people. And I was performing this summer at a county fair, and one of my college friends arranged to come, and she brought her kids. And then all of a sudden, they surprised me with one of our other friends showed up. That was really nice.
Aww.
It's really satisfying. Yeah, it's really nice to run into these old friends and meet their kids.
Oh, that's great to hear that you have that experience. Because no one has from my high school has yet shown up to one of my stand-up comedy shows, but they know I. No, that's a lie. I just remembered somebody did show up once. But I mean, everyone who I grew up with knows that I do stand up now, and that it's a serious career move for me. Like, pre-pandemic, I was a year into being a full-time comedian, actor, and performer and entertainer. And then the pandemic hit and ruined all of that. Now you can see why I still have reasons to talk about the pandemic. But but it's nice to get occasionally messages from people that who I grew up with. They're like, hey, I'm glad to see you're following your dreams. I'm glad to see you're doing that. Is there people who are from your former professional life as a microbiology, was it microbiology? Yeah, wildlife biology. Sorry, not micro.
Yeah,
Wildlife
no
biology,
worries.
totally different things. Got it. Remember when I was bad at remembering names? Also bad at remembering
Well,
college degrees.
it's
I did go to 6 years of community
not
college and didn't
important, like the
graduate.
college degree.
The college degree that you no longer use. Do you find old professionals being supportive, like, thank God you got out. Thank God you're doing what you want to do?
Oh, no. No, other than those couple college friends that I really bonded with, not really. No, there's nobody from the past that pops up. Not these days.
Well, I'm making the transition to a full-time performer. Is it okay if I call it clowning?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It,
I don't
what
want to
I do is
insult.
based on clowning. I don't often use the word clown because it scares people away.
Oh, let's talk about that. Before we get into anything else personal, what is
Okay.
with the pejorativeness of the word clown? Like, I am
I
a firm
know.
believer in there's a lot of things that we do in this world where we just go with the flow and say that we're don't like it. Or, like, example, have you ever met a single person that admits to being good at math? No, everyone says they're bad at math, and I think we're conditioned and trained.
I live in the Bay Area and it's filled with engineers and coders.
Okay, well, so the theory that I have is that we learn to just respond to certain things in the majority way that we continue here. Like the example I'm using is everyone goes, oh, I'm bad at math. Well, it's statistically impossible that everyone that you meet is bad at math, except for the people who work with math, like accountants and engineers and stuff like that. I meet so many people that just say they're bad at math. And it's like, I think you're just programmed to say you're bad at math because we've grown up so much with people saying that they are bad at math. So we go with the majority flow of that. And I think there's a lot of people that we have been conditioned so much to say clowns are creepy and scary that we just go, oh, well, I'm supposed to then think clowns are creepy and scary because we as the society have deemed that so. Same thing with the argument of pineapple on pizza. Like, nobody actually hates pineapple pizza, but it became a meme of popular culture for us to all just go, oh, let's have a fight about pineapple on pizza.
I love clowns, and I love Hawaiian pizza.
The fruit deserves to be on pizza. Who cares, right?
But I'm still bad at math.
I mean, statistically, people can be bad at math, but also statistically, people should be good at math who aren't working with math every day. But so how are you trying to overcome the stigmata of people going, oh, clown, scary?
Right. So, our current American culture, I think, is afraid of clowns, starting with Stephen King's It really popularized the scary clown, and it just sort of cascaded from there. And I think every genre of clown, you know, it's an expression, it's an art form, like, scary clown is a thing.
And first off, we can blame Stephen King for this, but I refuse to let Tim Curry take the blame for it. He is innocent of the frightening of clown culture. Tim Curry, who played It in the original series, I don't blame him, but I'll let Stephen King take that blame.
Yeah, Tim Curry's just the messenger. But clowning, you know, has its roots in, I think, Commedia dell'arte, like, you know, this like old Italian art theater art form from the 1800s. And so there's like the theory of what clowning is, and then there's like the physicality of a clown. It's like, are you making a cake from a box, or are you like a culinary artist?
I have friends who are clowns, and they've talked to me about the original arting, the artistic styling of clowning. And there is very different fields of it.
There's so many genres of clown. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Is there one that you felt naturally gravitated towards? Because honestly, I can never do the silent mime clown stuff.
Oh my gosh, I tried. Yeah, so when I, you know, started as an early performer, that's my favorite type of performance is silent physical comedy. And so I tried so hard to be like that and did so much training in mime and physical comedy. And at the end of the day, if you want to work in this modern world, and I work with kids, like you have to talk to them, because I'm in a lot of environments where you got to have audience management skills. You have to interact. The kids can't be guessing what you're trying to tell them. Like, I'm not the best mime. It's more like the physicality will enhance your story. So I'm much better speaking and with words. And then I found that out pretty early on. I tried to make a couple silent routines, and I was like, oh, this is not working. So...
Oh, trust me, there's a slew of people that would love to have me start doing silent comedy.
Yeah. So I did do some stand-up classes or, like, workbooks to, like, add that aspect to my show. So I do have a couple of routines that are, like, set up punchline, more like a street show.
So you found it important to learn how to write jokes for children.
Yeah.
Did you find it difficult to figure out how to write on the level of children? Like, I can write a joke. I can tell a story. I don't know if I can make it relatable to kids.
Yeah, every age group has their own understanding of comedy. And you know, younger kids aren't quite developed, so they respond really well to physical comedy, and they know what's funny, and if you get hit in the face, like a lot of Looney Tunes type of thing, like, that's funny. But then once you do that around adults, like, if you do it too much, it gets boring. I think it's harder to entertain adults because you have to learn the structure of a joke and get more into the verbal comedy like that. It's more intuitive for me to entertain for children. For me, it's just easier somehow. It's easier. I've been juggling for 25 years. I love to work with props. And so I have an understanding of how to manipulate the props to make them look surprising or interesting. And kids respond really well to that because it's so visual and it doesn't rely on language.
Would you say that's the big difference between performing for children and performing for adults is more physical comedy for you?
I think there's a lot of different elements that include physical comedy, repetition. Kids love repetition. Adults get bored of it, but children learn what happens, and then they expect to see it again and again and again. And they have this sense of power. They know what's going to happen. And then you can also use that to your advantage and break the expectations to create comedy. Definitely acting, when an adult acts like a child, that's hilarious to children. When you pretend to cry, throw a tantrum, kids love that because that's not normal for an adult. Like, we're all socialized out of that, more or less. So to see an adult break the rules and act like a child is like the funniest thing to a little kid.
Have you found it difficult managing your own business while also being a performer? Because when I was full-time entertainer and not working a day job, majority of my week went to just finding gigs, responding to budget or requests for budgets, doing corporate gigs. And were you able to move into that space of managing yourself with some competency? Because I did not. That was my biggest problem, was trying to find the work.
Right. So currently, especially after pandemic, there are not very many children's entertainers left. And I don't know, I think it's a problem. I want there to be more kids entertainers in the world, which is why I started making these videos on social media to, I don't know, maybe entice some people to get into the field and the art form, because, you know, we could always use some more joy and laughter and positive feelings. Yeah, I mean, like, currently in the Bay Area, I can think of like less than 20 full-time family entertainers.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I have no idea what that space is like, even in my local scene, because I'm also a single 43-year-old man without kids. So I'm not looking into children performers or how many there are or who would be appropriate for that.
Right. So, I'm explaining all that because there's not a lot of competition.
And which works to your benefit, really.
It works to my advantage. I've been doing this for coming up on 15 years in the Bay Area. I came into the profession with super solid skills. I've been juggling and unicycling and doing all this stuff since I was 15. I already had, I guess, 7 years under my belt. And then I learned to perform. So I came in with a huge advantage working in with children and families. I'm a woman. I'm skilled. I'm good with people. So I did find success immediately because I was set up to succeed, because I was doing this as a hobby for a long time. I wasn't trying to make a living right away. So I would have been building my resume and my skills as a hobby. And then when I decided to go full time, it was just a matter of getting a good show. And I worked for a kids entertainment company that would send me to birthday parties under their name.
Okay.
So it was almost like a little bit anonymous. Like I could get all my bad shows out of the way. You know, you have to do like, I forget what they say, like 100 bad shows before you even do a good show.
One guy's like 10,000, you know, the 10,000 hours you have to put in. M. Gladwell.
Yeah, that guy. That smart guy. Who could do math?
Well, all right. Well, it's nice there that you worked with a company originally, because comedy, stand-up comedy, again, I can only come from my own perspective on a lot of things, but there's a lot of people who get into stand-up comedy because like, oh, I want to be a comedian. And you get two groups of people that start comedy. Ones who don't know where to start, and they ask everybody, where do I start? Where do I start? Where do I start? Where do I start? Or you get the people that automatically believe they deserve to be given their own Netflix special on day one.
Right.
But you have to learn, like, if I do anything with my life, it's to get people to understand that comedy is as much of a craft as any other form of entertainment. Acting also has this really bad habit where people are like, oh, I want to be an actor, so I'm an actor now. It's like, well, you've never trained, you don't know how to do it, and you're actually bad at it. But everyone's bad at, but everyone's bad when they start. You have to, you're going to say, I'm sure you have to fail before you can be good, right?
You have to fail so much,
right?
And experience so much humiliation in a way, and learn how to be resilient. I did street shows at Pier 39 for 2 years, and there's a lot of kooky characters out there, and you know, people just say anything to you. And I had a lot of bad shows out there, but I got my core street material. I have several different shows. I do have a show for adults, and it's mostly based on stand-up comedy, prop comedy, and all the things I developed at Pier 39. But I prefer working with kids because I get more illicit responses from them right away, and I feel like a kid at heart, and that energy feeds on each other, and I feel more joyful when I have kids in the audience, for sure.
How have you learned to deal with difficult children? Like, if you're performing, like, and I'm sure you have the benefit of when you show up somewhere, the kids are into it. And they're like, yay, a clown. Yay, a juggler. Yay, yeah. Happiness, joy, entertainment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I am, unfortunately, yeah. I have to teach these little shitheads about history, and none of them want to learn about history. So I have to, A, make it interesting. But there's people that come in. I mean, I've dealt with this as a stand-up comedian with adults who get dragged to the comedy show by their girlfriends, and they sit there like this, arms crossed the entire time.
Gosh,
and
yeah.
they're like, go ahead, try and make me laugh, funny man. Yeah. Why are you on the stage making my wife laugh? Why are you up there making my wife smile, but I'm not? Like, you get that.
Yeah.
And I can deal with that adult human. I can't deal with that with a 12-year-old in the same way. I'm not allowed to deal with it in the same way. I've already been reprimanded on this in the same way.
Yeah.
So I have to learn to do it with kid gloves. And that's for the past 2 years of doing this job as a Boston Duck Tour narrator, is learning how to deal with children in an appropriate way. Because I can do it funny. I can do it where we're all going to walk away and have a laugh at it. But then also at the same time, that's not the way to deal with kids. So what was the tricks and techniques that you learn for dealing with, or how you handle a difficult kid who's just sitting there at the thing, mm-hmm. like, harumph, or giving you, mm-hmm. like, oh, you're super cringe.
Yeah. It is not uncommon to go to a birthday party where I'm there to entertain a bunch of 4 to 6-year-olds, and then there is an older sibling in the back, just kind of like this. But in that scenario, I'm there for the kids. And I generally ignore that teenager or like preteen who doesn't appear into it.
I've had 34 of them in a duck boat, 34 of them like this. And I was like, oh,
that's intimidating.
No. I like the people at work. They're like, the people at work is like, you got to show no fear. Teenagers can smell fear. Don't be afraid. I was like, oh, I'm not afraid of them. I'm afraid to get fired for roasting them. That's what I'm afraid of.
Yeah. Sometimes in some scenarios, I'll find, okay, so like at the county fair, one county fair this summer, I did have a bunch of preteens in the audience, but they were into it. So they were friendly. And I ended up picking one of them to do, to be a volunteer in my puppet routine. And I normally don't pick teenagers to interact with the puppet routine, but they were like so smiley and so into it. And And I ended up doing it. And you know, when like all the friends are kind of embarrassed for their friend or like into it because they think their friend might be embarrassed. It was kind of like that situation happening. But so my audience management comes in. If there's a child who's proactively interrupting the show and sort of like derailing the experience for everybody, that's when I come in and I try to shut it down. So it starts when you walk in the room and you declare who you are, what you're doing. You make your space for the show, and really, the space is kind of on your terms for the show. So I like to physically define the space by putting down a blanket and like literally that physical barrier of I'm over here with the show and you're over here in the audience is the first technique of like, you know, they might start coming up onto the show to like grab the things out of my hands or grab things out of my suitcase. And so you can immediately like, no, go back over here. And complimenting the other kids, I do that right away. Like, blah blah is sitting down, crisscross applesauce. Look at this kid. This is a great example. She's ready for the show. Are you ready for the show? If you're ready for the show, let me see you start clapping. If you're ready for the show, let me see you put your hand on your head. Like, kids want to please you. Like, they like to do that. So give them easy things to do that they can accomplish. And so I kind of get this group mentality energy going where they're going to listen to me like a teacher would.
That's a really good technique there, pointing out positive behavior and influencing it amongst the kids who are being less than
If it
perfect.
gets if it gets to a point where it's so out of control of one child just repeating the same thing over and over and over, then I take drastic measures. And you use
Oh, I
peer
can't wait to hear about
pressure.
drastic members and drastic
Drastic
measures in
measures
classing.
is using peer pressure, and you make all the other kids, you give that kid all the attention they wanted, but in a negative way. And you're like, look, we can't enjoy the show. Do you see all these kids here? They want to see me do this trick, but you're stopping us. Like, we can't. And then you ask the audience, do you want this kid to sit down and be quiet? Yes. Like, it's like this psychological peer pressure in a way of turning the audience against that one kid, turning the audience, but not in an embarrassing or humiliating way, just of a recognition of like, look, we're all waiting on you. This is a group experience, so please be part of the group.
Oh wow, that's such a good technique to do. And I've realized in past I've done similar things where I've had to like just and with both adults and certain kids shows that I've done where it's like, hey, look, everyone else is clearly having a good time. You can have a good time and be like everybody else, or you can just sit there and be quiet and suffer. It's up to you. Or I've done that where I've had I remember I did a I got requested I did a private gig for a DMLA, which is the teenage children's group of it's the Boy Scouts for Freemasons, basically.
Oh, okay.
And one of the kids, one of the gentlemen, little boys, the teenage kid, was heckling and interjecting, and I was like, look, I was already given a check for this. It's gonna clear. I deposited in my bank account. I'm already paid. I can leave now. I don't care. But 28 other of the people here are enjoying yourselves, right? See?
Yeah, exactly. Who's enjoying themselves? Well, they are, and if you're not, why don't you leave? Like, why are you here?
Make some applause. Who wants to hear me tell jokes? Ah! Who here wants to see me argue with Jeremy over here?
I'm not opposed to shutting them down. I'm not opposed to shutting them down. Like, well, now I know why some mothers eat their young. Like, if the kid's old enough, I'll say that. There are stock lines from the street that come from the street performing culture world.
I love
I
that.
find
I mean,
it.
I have a slew of those too, but I had to learn. That's the problem. Again, going back to the company I work for, is that I have to learn to do it much more gently now. One of my favorite has been when dealing with kids. If I try to be interactive and ask them questions, but if one of them says something dumb or something, obviously they're like, oh, I'm gonna say like, do you guys know what the Underground Railroad is? Yeah, it's the subway. Like. when we're talking about, like, you know, the Harriet Tubman and stuff
Right.
Yeah, that underground railroad. When I would bring something up like that, and a kid would say something obviously like that, I could look at him and go, man, you know, sixth grade is going to be really easy for you the second time around.
Yeah.
You know, or something similar to that. I love that. Now I know why some mothers eat their young. I don't know if I can get away with it at Boston Duck Tours, but one way to find out. We'll find out if I get fired. But no, it's. But yeah, so you've developed those stock lines by street performing. For you as a street performer, just to talk more about the business of clowning, because every city has a difference in street performing. Like here in Boston, there is no really form of busking. The only places you can do it, you know, there's only legally certain places you can do it, and they've all now been controlled by property management groups.
Oh my God, I know you guys have Faneuil Hall.
And Faneuil Hall is ran by a realtor group, and they do auditions once a year. And there was talk, and I got to look into this because I'm really curious what ended up happening. They were charging for audition applications, which is basically pay to play now. So for you, how did you find navigating the world of street performing for you? Because like in Scotland, when I was in Edinburgh and Glasgow, you could just stand on a street corner and play a bagpipe and throw a hat on the ground and people pay. They just let you do that. Here in Boston, that is not a thing that you can easily do. Like the subway stations have performers, but they're only letting certain people do the performing at certain places. You have to apply for applications and stuff. It's management-wise for a performer, a nightmare.
Yeah. It's also very highly regulated in the Bay Area. The most popular area is Pier 39 on Fisherman's Wharf. It's also private property. It's also managed by a company, and you have to audition. Since I've been in this world for so long, from a teenager developing into an adult, I already knew the people who were running the program, and I would go down there at least a couple times a month to watch everybody's street show. So if you are interested in joining a community like that, you have to know who the community, like showing up, I think is fine and a great freedom. But also like if you want to keep working with the people on a long-term basis. So I would show up and just watch everybody's show and get to know the people and see who they are. I'm also a member of our local magic clubs and there's a lot of overlap in these professional organizations. So I already knew the people running the peer growth program and they asked me if I wanted to audition. And I'd always been so curious about street performing. There's something so magical and romantic about the idea of you can show up somewhere with like a couple props, create a show, create this joyful experience and pass the hat and make a living. Like that's such a nice romantic idea. And the reality of it is that it can be a nightmare and it can be really humiliating and you fail a lot. And, you know, I was getting like $20 hats some days because I was scheduled for Tuesday at noon.
Mm. Yeah, there's that navigating that area of, you know, like there's some like as a comedian, we've done a lot of shows for passing a hat at bars and restaurants, which is like we're bringing business to them. Why are you doing a show where we're not getting paid? Anyway, I'm sure you have a slew of stories.
So many tangents here. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the problems that I had with. All right, so the thing I was going to say is I had to get over that, hey, everybody, this was a free show that you were here for, but shows like this typically cost around $20, $25. If you would like to donate something to the performers here, all the money is going to go to the performers. I can make it funny. Like I could say, every dollar you donate today goes to every one of the comedians on the show's copay for antidepressants, you know, something like that to just make it less awkward, like, please give us money for our jokey fun times. And
yeah,
that was something I had to learn to get over.
Yeah.
And there's so many comedians that I have to tell who are starting out. They're like, oh, I don't want to do the solicit for money. It's too awkward. It's like, yeah, well, get past it. Like when I sell merch, I make jokes to sell merch with. So I'm not up there going, hey, buy my coffee cup, you know, that has a joke on it, you know.
It's such a powerful skill. But if you learn the hotline and if you learn how to talk about money and ask for what you want, you become so much stronger at negotiating, not backing down on your price, charging the right amount. And it's useful to other people too, because I've been in some situations where there might be an auction or a fundraiser and like the average mom isn't asking for money. I mean, so it's good to have those skills and share it with people.
And that's the thing also I was going to bring up is the slew of stories where you have where somebody reached out to you, hey, can you come perform on this thing? You tell them what the price is like, why does it cost so much? That was my biggest problem as a pre-pandemic doing corporate gigs. You know, not even corporate, just people reaching out like, hey, come to my grandfather's 89th birthday and tell jokes in front of the whole family. You want $300 for that?
Yeah.
I'm funny. I just give myself $300, which you have a legitimate skill. You'd be like, all right, go juggle and play on a unicycle. Like people know there's a value into those skills.
See you in 5 years. You learn that. Yeah, people don't realize all the work it takes and they don't realize all the failures you've gone through to figure out what doesn't work and what does work. And like, I don't even bring that up anymore on the phone. I don't even try to argue these days. If you don't want it, we're not the right fit. You're not a good client for me. Bye bye. So it's nice to have the power like in my life right now to do that. I still get a hit up to this day to do X, Y, or Z for exposure.
The thing I love to say about exposure is you can't eat exposure. You can't pay your rent with it, but it is the thing that too much of it can kill you.
Yeah. I'm very, very lucky now to have been doing this for professionally over 10 years. And so I have a good footing. I have a great reputation. I have a great show. And so I just ignore all those things. Or I lie and I say, I'm sorry, I'm already booked. Like, I just lie. Because there are genuine small groups around in the area who are putting on a fundraiser. And if I feel strongly about the cause, like, I'll do it. I have my volunteer organizations I work for. But, strangers cold calling you and asking for stuff just doesn't work.
When you're getting to the point with your career where you've done your act, you know it, how do you keep it fresh for you? Do you constantly try to work on new material? Do you have a plethora? Was like, my show's 45 minutes. I have 3 hours of material. This week, I'll do a different set of 45s. Or how do you, because me, my 80-minute history tour is the same set. It's the same route and the same sites. And it's getting stale, and I'm a firm believer in it's the first time for all of them. Mm-hmm, so that's what keeps me going and motivated. But there's definitely times where I was like, man, I wish I had a new joke for Trinity Church.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. I generally do. The show is pretty identical all the time. I just put in a new puppet routine this summer. That's something I had been wanting to do. So that kept it really fresh for me for 8 minutes of the 30-minute show this summer. But I definitely, a couple years ago, found myself on repeat. And you just have to constantly remind yourself, like, be present. Don't check out. This kid's having a great time. We're having a great time together. I'm having a great, like, I'll just pick different people in the audience. I'm really big on eye contact. So I, like, really latch on to who's out there and who's actually looking at me. Keeping it fresh. I have a yearly gig as an elf, and I like to learn one new magic trick every year, which builds my magic repertoire and keeps it fresh for me and the people I interact with. I work at a gingerbread house every Christmas, and so the same people come back year after year after year after year, and I have moms coming up to me being like, look, it's you with my kid when they were 5, and now the kid is like, 16, like that's pretty amazing. Yeah, that's pretty amazing experience. That actually happened to me this weekend. I was face painting at a country club and this mom came over and she's like, oh my God, you're the elf. Look at you and my kid from, pre-pandemic times. So I like to keep it fresh by, yes, learning new things, because the show can be very plug and play. You know, you got to do like the A material for like 80% of the show. And then there's a little bit of wiggle room for new stuff.
Well, let me, have you ever considered, or do you maybe work with other similar acts and performers to maybe develop new gags? Or have you like gone to other professionals in your industry's shows and like, that's a really good trick. I wonder if I can do my own version of that. Cause that's sometimes how I write my jokes, as I'm watching another comedian, and then I'll predict the punchline. And they will say something different. I was like, oh, cool. I just wrote a new joke now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I do a lot of collaboration with people. I'm a solo performer. I don't do a lot of collaboration in terms of performance-wise, but I'm real big on community. And like I said, I like the magic clubs. There's juggling clubs. There's face painting meetups. I'm very social. There's clown jams, clown workshops. So I like to dip into all of those little genres. And I have my own cohort of kids entertainers here in the Bay Area where we meet up. We've been friends for so long. Like, we discuss, like, issues. We still rehash the same story. Like, this mom got so mad because her kid had to wait in line for balloons. Like, we still gripe about the same stories, you know, like, 5 years later, it's a nice support group. So in the Bay Area, we have a very friendly kids entertainer scene. SoCal has a very friendly kids entertainer scene. I'm trying to break out more and meet more across the USA. There are kid entertainer conventions. And so I'd like to go to some more of those next year and connect with people.
Do you other than, and like, are you trying to find a way to travel more outside of the immediate California, Bay Area, SoCal, or like, do you find yourself being able to find gigs now that social media is becoming bigger? Are you able to find a legitimate reason to travel to areas? Is trying to do what you do, putting a tour together for what you do, even quite a possibility? Going back to who you seem to know, who Jack the Whipper is, and his friend Seth Carney, the two of them and a couple other people in their sphere are doing traveling Renaissance fairs now, where they're spending the summer every weekend, or, you know, every month they're at a different Renaissance fair. They're going to different cities, different states. Is that for you something you're looking into, and would that be a possibility?
The Ren Fair Market looks so fun. I am in the county fair market. So the county fair is a little bit different in that there's no passing the hat. But yes, you can build a tour off of it. And it's kind of the same thing where the organization, you know, has to know who you are. There's probably a booking agent, a booking manager, and they're going to like look at your show and see if you're appropriate for that fair. So, yeah, I was able to travel up to Oregon this summer to bring Silly Circus Show to some Oregon County fairs. And I did fairs around the Bay Area. And I'm connecting with agents who book fairs in the Midwest. And I'm not too particularly interested in touring the Midwest for long. We'll see what happens with that. So, yes, I get to travel based on my own private bookings. And then in terms of social media, I don't think I'm big enough on social media to have people flying me out to X, Y, and Z and places like that.
Yeah, I guess there hasn't been a, you know, a quinceanera that's like, let's bring the Silly Circus out here to Georgia.
Yeah, the thing is like, those people do exist, though. Like, living here in the Bay Area, I know there's people with huge budgets like that. And I am very curious about some of the popular kids entertainers on social media. Like, are they flown across the U.S. to private parties? I don't think they are. I think they might be talking about it more. But that's something I'm trying to build my social media a little more. And that video you saw keeps getting more and more and more views since last week. And I'm really excited about some of that visibility now.
Yeah. Cause I enjoyed watching your performances, and It's an interesting place where you and I are in the social media sphere, in that comedians, we don't want to put the same joke. We're very private about our jokes.
Oh yeah.
And, like it's same
in this community. Yeah.
It's hard to try and you see with stand-up comedians, a lot of crowd work, because nobody wants to burn their material by putting it out on it. Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, I watch people like Rick Smith, who's a magician and holds the world record for card throwing. And if you watch his TikTok, and this is not a diss on Rick whatsoever, he's super talented, but he has the same, watch me steal this guy's watch trick. He has 100 of those videos on there, and it's the same exact act 100 times in a row of him stealing a person's watch with the same trick. There's no variation to it whatsoever. And it's very talented and very good. And I'm not dissing on him for it. What I'm saying is I'm envious of him because he's putting that clip out there and he knows he can put it out there again because there's going to be a new audience of people seeing that same trick, but this new video now that they didn't see 3 months ago when he put it out. So I think about that sometimes too, where it's like, yes, I'm doing the same act live in front of people because it's a new act it's new to these people, even though I've been doing the joke for 5 years or whatever. It can be that same way with social media sometimes. You know, like the people who are watching us on social media, they're not seeing every single one of our acts, every one of my jokes. Mm-hmm. And then if they go
rotating audience. Yeah.
Right. So you were saying that in your community too, there's a little bit of that privacy where you're like, oh, I don't want to put my things on there. And I think you're super talented. And what really made me want to talk to you is that you are now like in that space of, let me explain why these jokes work. Let me explain. And I've seen two or three of those videos in that sphere now from you. And I'd love to talk to shop. Entertainment shop. There is nothing more boring than talking about how comedy is made, but I love it to no extent. I love the nuance of it. There's a writer from The Simpsons who's also been falling into my algorithm, where he's talking about, you know, sympathetic characters and ironic dispositions and all this. And I'm just, I love all of it. So I'm really happy with that space. So was there something in particular that's inspired you to push into that? Let me explain how to perform for children.
Yeah, I think people are just so curious, and this is a niche industry that nobody knows about. And there's only so many videos I can make, like you said, of your friend stealing a watch off a guy or throwing a card into a hat. Like for me, so I'm lucky that I have unlimited things I can do. But it gets boring from my perspective. So that's why I started making some of these videos of, have you ever wondered why a kid's entertainer is always making mistakes? People are just so naturally curious. And I want to share some of that with people. And I'm not afraid they're going to steal my material or they're going to steal my idea. Like the idea I present in the videos are just timeless techniques that work. Magicians are notorious for protecting their secrets and their techniques. I'm not a magician. I don't think, it took me 3 years to be able to learn to idle on a unicycle and juggle. Like when you combine all that, like I'm not afraid somebody's going to steal my trick. That's also not my trick. That's like a common trick people do. And if you do end up learning it, great. We'll probably be friends because we have something in common. And I truly believe that nobody can do the routine like me. So I do have a lot of material online. And I already know people steal. I've had my costumes being copied. I've had my jokes being taken. I've had my tricks being taken. And, you know, there's no trademark or anything in this type of art form. So the best I can do is move on and not worry about what somebody's copying from me, but explain it a little bit and, like, position myself as an expert and you know, set myself up for teaching. I'd love to teach and coach more people. Because we need more kids entertainers. We need more.
I love that you have that thought where you're like, if somebody's stealing my thing, whatever, I'm going to move on. I'm going to continue to do it. Because so many people are bogged down in that realm here in stand-up comedy. It was like, Conan O'Brien stole my joke. No, he didn't. Like, Maybe you just thought of this, you know, parallel thinking is so common and so explainable every day in every single Facebook, Reddit, community board of stand-up comedy. That every day somebody posts, somebody stole my joke. What do I do about it? Write another joke.
And that's why clowning is so interesting, because like 10 people could drink a glass of water and that might be the joke, but how do you drink the glass of water and how are you doing it and how are you telling the joke? So that's where the talent comes in and makes you different.
Yeah, I love hearing that. But it's also, I know magicians are so protective with their materials because it's, magic is not easy. Like, especially when you get into upper level, like real magicians doing like, there's so many of them who are also like, I love magic. I love magicians. I want to know how all of it's done. That's the world that I live. I look up, remember the masked magician on Fox, whatever that guy. I watch every episode because I want to know how all of it's done. But also at the same time, I get why they're protective of it, because it ruins the joy for other people. But at the same time, I can understand where it would make you mad that somebody took the thing that you worked hard on creating yourself that no one else can really do. Like, everyone can write a joke, you know, for the most part. It's really hard to do parallel thinking when it comes to magic.
Right. So I do have one trick I do feel a type of way about. And I'm balancing an umbrella on my face and it's open. And then I can make it close on command whenever I want. So that is, that's a method I discovered on my own. Nobody showed it to me. I do feel protective of it. I'm never going to reveal the secret in a video of how I do it.
All right, hold on. I'll pause the recording. Hold on. Let me just pause the recorders. Okay. I'll sit down. Come on. Tell me. Come on. There's nothing being recorded right now. It's just between you and me. It's just you and me here, Bri. It's only here. The podcast is off. It's just you and me here. It's just the two of us. Just the two of us.
Here's how it works.
Don't tell me. Don't actually tell me.
You have to think positively. You have to think it for it to happen.
Oh, you have to think positively? All right. Well, I'll never be able to do that trick because of depression. So, all right.
So I relate to the magicians. I do have my things I'm protective about. And even like, blah, blah, blah. You could never trademark anything. Like, I'm not going to tell anybody how that works. And if you guess it, fine. If you figure it out, fine. Good for you. You're smart. But I resonate with that. Like, people put time and creative energy into their things. And
do you sometimes find it difficult to enjoy other performances, just because you've seen so much of it? Yeah. Like, I get really annoyed when people who are doing magic tricks that are stock magic tricks, like, everybody could do the car. Everyone does the card through the window thing. You know, the trick.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's on the other side of this glass. How did it get there? And I'm okay with people doing that trick. But when people do the trick with the setup and the story and the approach and all of it's the exact same as 1,200 other comedians who do the same or magicians who do the same thing, then I roll my eyes and get upset about that. I don't mind seeing the methods used, but I want to see them done in new, interesting ways. So I find it difficult to be entertained by other people because I have so much of the entertainment business knowledge. Is it also difficult for you sometimes watching somebody and you roll your eyes like, oh, that's that, you know, in our world, we say that's the hackiest thing. Like my beauty of watching someone tell a joke is not showing me the formula of the joke. If you can tell me a joke and the formula is hidden so well that I don't notice it, I'm elated. Is that similar to you where you have difficulty enjoying entertainment?
Yeah. So if I'm watching a magician that's doing a really common trick, I enjoy it more if they're being authentic and showing me their true personality. Because a lot of magicians do put on this facade of like, pick any card, you know, that I even do it with the performer facade. There's like a performer voice that actually has been plaguing me. How do I get out of the performer voice? Like, why do I talk like that? I only talk like that because other people talk like that. And most of them are men. Like, why am I talking like that? And I still find
voice.
Myself, yes, I still find myself slipping into that stereotype because it works. It does work for some reason. Maybe that's what people expect.
When I would host trivia, a couple of my regular trivia people would come out. They'd come up to me, like, "Hey, I didn't hear the question. Can you read it again?" And I'll pull it out. I was like, "On the eve of," and they were like, "Did you just do it in an announcer voice again? Like off the mic, I talk normal, and then as soon as I get on the microphone, I get into announcer voice because that's part of my character for trivia, you know." Yes. But it's also like, instinctively, you're just like, "Well, I'm announcing something, so I get into Bob Barker voice."
Step right up. Silly circus show is happening in just 5 minutes. Run away with the circus. Yeah, I do it too. And so, yeah, talking about like really minute performer niche things is like, that's one thing that's been in the back of my mind is like, why am I doing that? Why are we doing that as a whole? And who's not doing that? Who's not conforming and still getting attention? So when I watch another magician doing like the standard blah, 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 I like them to break out of the performer voice and be a little authentic, tell a personal story. But if you're learning, I get it. Like I copied a lot of people when I was starting out because it's hard to find your voice until you do it, 10,000 times.
In stand-up, there's so many people that start, like, when I started doing stand-up, I was a Dennis Leary copycat.
Yeah.
I grew up watching so many people try to be Sam Kinison's. I watched so many people in this industry, your slew of wannabe Dane Cooks, your slew now of wannabe Bill Burr's, and your slew of wannabe Joe Rogan's. They mm-hmm. all come through in so much of that. Do you think finding your authentic voice is one reason why you create your own props? Do you think that helps you try to be more you and more unique in your tricks and in your performances?
Yeah. I love making props. I love building things. And it's just, I will say, yes, I am driven to be unique. And it's like, oh, I've never seen this. And yes, those things exist in other places and people, like, for example, one of the things, I don't think it's up here right now. I have a box I hold and it says monster box. And then poof, this monster hand comes out.
Ooh.
And I started talking with a couple friends about it and they're like, "Oh, I made something like that." And somebody made, and like the hand was thing. But I love building. First of all, I can't get it out of my brain. Like I can't rest or move on with my life until I bring it to life. So I enjoy spending my time doing that, making props, making costumes.
Has Carpentry YouTube channels started falling into your algorithm because of you making all your own props and stuff like that?
Carbon what?
Carpentry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I get a ton of videos, even of just like refurbishing furniture. I love those videos. transforming a room. A lot of like DIY crafty type things. A lot of puppet stuff. I get a lot of puppet stuff on my feed.
Yeah, I got into a little of the puppeteers guy. There's a puppet performer who makes puppets and I just fall into Adam. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Oh, I got into that.
I got into his pandemic page, and now it's giving me all kinds of other puppet things. And I'm like, no. Yeah. I just want this one.
Or
like, part of the reason why I was like, oh, I should really talk to Bree is I am also trying to improve my podcast guest image. This is just human me stuff. This is just girl talk.
Yeah.
And that the reason I wanted to have a performer is also because in my life now I have to, deal with children and have to learn to perform for them. But also I have a friend who works at a very big puppetry company that I'm going to remain nameless right now, but it's the one you're thinking of. And I've been trying to get this person on the podcast, but the company won't let them because I talk to a lot of comedians and we get super dirty about things. And they're like, it's not a clean podcast. So you're also here to help clean up my podcast guest image.
Oh, Bruce, this has been so wholesome.
You're doing double duty, all right?
I just saw the new Jim Henson documentary. I don't know if that's the puppet company you're talking about, but
no way saying anything about Sesame Street.
There's a new Jim Henson documentary. It's so good. It was really good.
I haven't seen it yet, but I want to.
I want to get on Sesame Street. I need to write that down. I don't know if they've ever had a juggler.
Put that out in the world. Say it out loud. Put it in the world. Yeah. I'm hoping it works out for you for that. But so one of the things that I always have to, I don't have to ask this question, but I feel it's my obligation. As a cis white straight male performer who presents as white, there is things about your world of you being a female in the performance space that I can't unfortunately ever understand. And no, I don't want to have to ask these questions, but it is also important to let this information be out there for the other people like you. Like I said earlier in the podcast, you grew up as a woman in the field where there's not a lot of women in magic. I'm sure there's not a lot of female jugglers. There's not a lot of women in the clown space. There might be more women in clowning than any of the other things put together. Mm-hmm. Street performing can be an incredibly dangerous space for you. Like,
yeah.
I talk about this all the time with my other female comedian friends that, you know, she had a drunk guy, you know, verbally harassing her, like in a sexual nature, and she froze. She didn't have to do it. Someone else had to step in. Whereas I had a similar situation when I first started out in comedy over 20 years ago, a guy who, you know, I insulted, you know, he was a heckler and I insulted him to the point that he bum rushed the stage. And the difference between you and me is I bashed him in the face with the bottom of the mic stand because physically capable of doing that. All right. I grew up in an unfortunate, you know, violent life as a youth and in a city that where that was common. So I could defend myself in those ways. And I don't know what that is. I don't know how to live in that world. Like other comedians, not all comedians know how to fight. Most of them don't. I'm the rarity of it. And I'll probably get beat up now if I try to fight anybody. That's why I've stopped fighting. But for you as a woman in this space, one of the things that I always find interesting when I talk to women in performance who say, oh, I didn't know any other female comedians growing up because there weren't very many. Me, on the other hand, loved Lucille Ball, loved Judy Gold, loved Joan Rivers, loved Gilda Radner and Jane Curtin, all those. Like, I saw those. Did you find it difficult to find female performers in your space to be inspired by?
All my role models are men in terms of this performance space of family entertainment. I do have like role model, like, yeah, Lucille Ball and some of these more iconic women who, have these values or like the thing, but in terms of my industry, no, I can't think of any famous or well-known female family kids entertainers.
Was that awkward for you? Or did you never not notice it?
I think now, 20 years later, reflecting and the whole Me Too movement and like reflecting on my journey, I was pretty clueless of how I was being treated, of situations I was in. And it's just kind of like, well, this is how it is. This is how it is. And I feel like I have experienced a lot of benefits and I've experienced negative things with this gender dynamic. And some positive things are working with kids, being in a family environment, being trusted more because I'm a female. Having a more feminine energy, I think, brings a different experience maybe to an event. And when I started, I was more of a generalist. I did a lot of corporate walk around. I did any job that came my way. And I've been bothered and harassed before while working as an entertainer. And over the years, it just sort of like, I've just started chiseling down what do I like and what do I don't like. And like, I don't like to work late nights. I don't like to work in bars. I don't like to work in environments where alcohol's the main thing. So that's how I ended up really focusing on this channel of being a children and family entertainer, is because I feel safe there. I feel more safe as a woman, as a solo performer. And that's why, and I do feel like I connect with kids more than adults on the entertainment level. And that really did shape where I am today. feeling safe and comfortable in the family and children environment, because I did experience a lot of other things. And then another area where I feel sometimes not very valued is in negotiations or the buying areas. For example, I have gone to trade shows where you're trying to sell your show, or it's like a showcase, and I'm there in the booth, I'm alone. This has happened more than once. Like, a guy comes up to me, and he's some kind of booker, and he's like, "Oh, this looks really great. Where's your partner? Where's your husband? Where's your boyfriend?" And I'm like, "Oh, it's just me.
Excuse me, little lady who's the performer. Can I speak to the man in the company,
please?" Yeah. And I live in a bubble. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. Like, in general, I feel pretty equal. But then I go to these other spaces where it's a little more, I don't know, patriarchal. And so, and then, you can see these men's face change. Like, "Where's your husband?" And then they're like, "What?" And they're like, "Oh, so you do the show alone?" "Yeah, I do the show alone." "Well, does that work?" And I'm like, "Do you see these 20 other solo magicians here at the trade show? They have their own solo show, and they do it alone."
"Excuse me, how do you do an entire solo show if you're just the assistant to the man?"
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it has been very frustrating over the years, and it's just kind of like, okay, well, I wanted to say was fuck those guys, and then I was like, and then I remembered, oh, I guess this, I can say that on this podcast. You know, you experience those things and you're like, fuck those guys. These guys over here are going to pay me $1,000 for blah, 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 blah. So fuck those guys, because I don't need them. So it is more of gravitating towards where you're wanted. And yeah, I don't, like, I'm not desperate. I don't need to be at your fair if you think my husband should be there with me.
By the way, I do want to point out, it only took us 80 minutes to get to the point where we now lost that Sesame Street interview still. No, awesome. I love that you shared that information and that with me, but I do hate to hear that you had that experience to be able to share. I'm sorry.
Yeah, like,
it has to be a conversation still in this day and age. Like, oh, I just grew up,
so
if you want to make something
to
normal, you just make it normal. You know, like, that's the way that I grew up. If you want something to become part of the norm, treat it as normal. But unfortunately, we're still in the world where we can't do that, unfortunately. And I can only hope that someone listening to the podcast can hear your story and be energized to fight past some of that patriarchal bollocks. And I don't look, if you want to, if anyone listening to this podcast now thinks that I'm sounding woke, I'll fight you in the street. I don't care. All right. Is there anything less woke than wanting to fist fight in the street over letting women have equal rights? Then okay, that's what I'm going to, then that's the stance I'm going to take on this whole conversation. But it's inspiring words to say that you're at the position where you're at in your career because you did not back down to the people that treated you unfairly in those ways. And even if you're not a woman and you're listening to this podcast, me as a guy, the reason why I ask these questions is because I've also similarly felt powerless in certain situations. Maybe it's not because of my gender, but it's because of societal norms. Like, my appearance is something that I have to break through a barrier with certain people. You know, I'm a very gregarious person. I'm 5'6", but I take up a lot of space proverbially in a room. You can feel my presence. I have that. And that can be off-putting to people. And, you know, some places that I'm not conventionally attractive, that also ruins certain people's opinions about you. So even me, myself, have to feel like the TV show Captain Marvel from the Marvel show, Miss Marvel, with the young Pakistani young lady who gets superpowers. If that show was not just in general made you sympathetic to because of having to deal with only family issues and cultural significance and norms, and just feeling powerless in a situation, well, then congratulations on never having to struggle in your life. It does not need to be just a show about or so that could be only related to people who have Pakistani descent. And just listening to your story, I'm sure there's people who have also felt similar ways, not necessarily because of their gender, but also because of their gender. And I'm glad that you've worked past it and that you shared that information with me and the listeners. So where can people find more of the Silly Circus Show and Bree Crabtree? If Crabtree is even your real name.
It is. Isn't that crazy? And there was a famous Crabtree in the Bay Area. I forget her name. Evelyn Crabtree. She was the highest paid vaudevillian star during the Gold Rush era.
Ooh,
and so that's what I'm aspiring. That's what I'm aspiring to.
Being the highest paid children's performer.
Yeah, with the name Crabtree. So, you can find content about Silly Circus Show under that handle, Silly Circus Show, on all the social media channels. And the Silly Circus Show channels are a little more filtered in terms of, I just show show clips. And then if you want to watch some behind the scenes content, you would follow my personal Instagram, Bree_Crabtree.
Awesome. And what's the, for the business and the career, what's, I think that we just said what your dream was Sesame Street. But what is the next big thing for you? What's the thing that you're working towards? Like me right now, when my tourism season ends, I'm planning a East to West Coast drive doing shows and spending time in LA and driving back. And that is a very daunting task. For you, is there anything on the horizon that you're working towards?
Yeah, I'd like to book out next summer, also doing a tour of county fairs. I'm going to keep going with the social media, creating more behind the scenes content. I'd like to do more teaching, education, and coaching. And I'm putting together a couple online courses for people.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, if you ever make it your tour shows come out to Boston, you reach out to me and I will be the creepy lone white guy sitting in the back row, waving and smiling and enjoying the show,
yes,
but doesn't it have
yes.
a child and everyone's like, he's a walking Amber Alert and I'll be there for you.
No, it's totally a family show. Everybody's welcome. Everybody's welcome. You don't have
to
have
say
kids.
That. Say that as a 40-year-old white man walking around Disney by yourself, which I have done because I went with my family and they stayed in one location and I stayed in another and I had to travel by myself. And when you're on that tram going from the hotel to Disney World, you are a walking Amber Alert. Everyone's like, what?
Right.
And similar to the way we're like, is your husband around? They look at you like,
right.
Is there a kid around or are you just shopping
you
for
just
one?
You just feel out of place. Yep.
Awesome. This has been great talking to you. I'm glad we got to have this conversation.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Poke some holes in the tie.